Thank you. A couple of quick comments before we get into the material. I have been asked about the book because apparently you've sold out, which warms the cockles of my heart. Wish I would have brought more. You can get the book at scr.org or Amazon. It's easy. Somebody said, what about the local Christian bookstore in town? I don't know if they carry it or not. I do not buy my books at bookstores characteristically anymore because it's just easier to go to one click on Amazon, and I have Amazon Prime, which is a fabulous, $70 a year. You get everything within 2 days, and there's no shipping fees. I mean, like, that's a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned. So it's easy to order online if you have access to that kind of thing. Somebody else asked me about the radio show. Is it in this area? I'm syndicated on the American Family Radio Network. I don't know if there's an affiliate in this town. My experience has been that it's much better to listen by podcast than it is to listen live, because there's no reception difficulties. You can take it wherever you want, listen whenever you'd like, and you can send it out to whoever you want to send it to if you think there's something worthwhile on there. The way to sign up for the podcast is go to iTunes and look up Stand to Reason and punch the button. It's very easy. You can also sign up on our website if you want to go to sdr.org. Either way is fine. You get an automatic download 3 hours a week. Shows up a day after the broadcast has been done. Usually this will be like Tuesday or Wednesday. And it's yours forever. So I recommend that you all sign up for the podcast. You might even want to follow me on Twitter or on my Facebook. I'm Greg Kokel on Twitter. I don't tweet a lot. Every couple of days, but I only put something that you'll find worthwhile. I don't tweet a bunch of nonsense. I want to offer somebody a thought in limited space that will be worthwhile. What we've done so far here this morning is we've talked about a new way of approaching the enterprise of engaging those who don't share our convictions. I've called it the tactical approach. Okay? And the tactical approach broadly has a very specific goal, and the goal is to give somebody something worth thinking about, to put a stone in their shoe. The goal is not to close the deal. All right? If you get to the gospel, that's fine, but you don't have to, because that's not the goal. You don't know whether that engagement will allow that kind of thing. The game plan that we use to accomplish the goal of putting a stone in somebody's shoe, get them thinking, is to ask questions. It's the Columbo tactic. I've talked about two uses of Columbo so far. One is to gather information using questions. The other one is to reverse the burden of proof using questions. Our first model question is, what do you mean by that? Our second model question is, how did you come to that conclusion? Okay, I want to talk about two other applications of this or concerns before I get into the third use of Columbo. I want to talk right now about what I call the professor's ploy. Now, the professor's ploy is a technique that professors use that inappropriately reverses the burden proof on a Christian. A lot of professors have it as their goal to destroy the confidence of Christians that come in their class. Are you a Christian? You won't be a Christian when I get through with you. That's their attitude. Some of you might have had teachers that are like that. But they are thick out there, just so you know. And so they will take opportunity in the class to take shots at Christianity, using their position of authority behind the podium, having the mic, and they will beat up on Christians' religious views. They'll say things like, well, the Bible's just a bunch of fables, and no idiot would believe in that, blah, blah, blah. Now, in that environment, you're going to have some students that are followers of Christ. They don't want to take this lying down. They want to raise their hand and get into a fight. And that they do. Now, I think that the raising the hand and then challenging the professor is right-hearted. I understand the motivation. I just think it's wrong-headed. Because there is a principle of engagement that is violated whenever somebody does that. And the principle is that you never make a frontal assault on a superior force in an entrenched position. This is suicide. This is Pickett's charge kind of stuff. You know, you don't want to do that. Now, I'm not saying that you break off the conversation. What I'm suggesting is that you use your tactics instead. So let's just say you're a student in a class with a professor who has been attacking the Bible. I don't know, what question might pop into your head that you might raise your hand and ask at this point?
What do you mean by that?
By the way, is that the kind of question a student should ask?
Yeah.
Is that a power play? No, that's exactly what you're supposed to be doing. So you ask, well, what do you mean by that? In some fashion, you ask for clarification, draw him out, you get more information from him. When he's done clarifying his point of view, what second question might pop into your head right now that you can ask of the professor? Now, how did you come to that conclusion? Now, professors oftentimes are going to figure out that you may be a Christian who is sandbagging with your questions. You're laying back a little bit in a position of safety. And so they're going to call you out. Right? And they might say something like, oh, you must be one of those Christians who believe the Bible is the Word of God. Every jot and tittle. All right, well, I've got a few minutes. I can give you a second here. Why don't you stand up and explain to the rest of the class why you believe that the Bible is not a bunch of fables. Go ahead, stand up. Let us know. Now, what has the professor just done there? He has taken the burden of proof and put it where? On the Christian's shoulders. Now, why is that inappropriate under these circumstances? Well, he's the professor, but more to the point, he is the one who made the claim. The Christian didn't make the claim. The Christian just asked a question. If you asked a question, you don't make a claim, you bear no burden. Strictly speaking, you're off scot-free. If all you're doing is asking questions, that's all you're doing. Now he is trying to stick you with it when he's the one who's made the claim. You see that? Okay. Don't take the bait. This is my counsel to you. Do not take the bait. That is, do not take the burden of proof to disprove somebody else's claim. I wouldn't even do that. I'd want them to defend it first. And you can say to the professor, if you're in a situation like this, you can say, well, professor, you don't know what I believe because I haven't even said it. I actually had a conversation in a party at a what's his name? He's a Saturday Night Live actor, comedian guy. This is about 15 years ago. And I've actually seen him in the airport once since then and talked with him about this conversation I had with his wife. What is his name? He's the guy who does the subliminal stuff. You know, he says, oh, that's a pretty dress. What a rag. You know, that kind of stuff. Who's that guy? God, I can't think of his name. In any event, I got invited to a party at his house. I ended up talking to his wife and her friend all night long about spiritual things. And all I was doing is asking questions. And they came back to me, well, you believe this, you believe that, you believe the other thing. And I said, wait a minute. I never said anything about what I believe. I've never said one thing about that. I've just been asking questions. Now, you've made some assumptions. They may be correct, maybe not, but I've never put anything on the line there. So I was in a position of complete safety. And so that's the value of this. Now, the professor, he's made the claim. He's put the burden of proof on you. You can say to the professor, wait a minute, you don't know what I believe. I haven't even said it. But more to the point, I'm not making any claims here. I'm just being a student. I'm just asking questions. That's all I'm asking. And if I'm asking questions being the students, I don't have any obligation to refute your own view. In fact, it strikes me that you have an obligation to defend it. Unless you just want us to take everything you say on faith. What do you think? No, don't say that. Back in a power play again with the professor. Okay. So that's the first thing I want you to notice about the burden of proof. This shift called the professor's ploy, where people try to shift the burden back on you. Some people have strange theological ideas, and I've had some that were challenged. They'll take their Bible and they say, disprove it. Well, wait a minute, it's not our job to disprove their strange theological ideas. It's their job to go to the Bible and show where the Bible teaches these things if they think they're biblical doctrines. That is absolutely crucial. If you have a doctrine that is not in the Bible, then it is not a biblical doctrine. By definition. And if it's not a biblical doctrine, then it's not a doctrine that the Christian church should be advancing as God's truth. Okay, here's another point that I want to make here about these first two questions. And this is called staying out of the hot seat. Staying out of the hot seat. Now, the hot seat is where you find yourself when you are engaged in a conversation with somebody else. And let's just say you're in persuasion mode. You're trying to give reasons for your own convictions. You're advancing your own view. And then it turns out in this conversation that the other person that you're talking with has a whole lot more information about some of this stuff than you do. They are professors. They turn out to be professors. They turn out to be religious leaders of some sort or whatever. I'm not saying that they're right, but you realize you're just a little outgunned. You're just little old you. And all of a sudden, this person you're talking to, even if they don't have letters, they just seem to know a whole lot more. And they're overwhelming you with information that you can't assess. You ever been in that situation? Like, oh my gosh. And more is coming at you and you don't know how to answer it because you're not trained in that. And other people may be listening and you're thinking, gee, I wish I would have never opened up my big fat mouth. You know? It's all Coco's fault, you see. Well, I'm going to tell you how you can escape that problem. Incidentally, when somebody is rolling over you like that with all this information, who is in control of the conversation at that point? You or the other person? The other person, okay? Remember, the tactical goal is for you to be in control of the conversation. Now you're out of control. They're running it, and you don't like where it's going. Okay? Now, it's not difficult to change the dynamic here, but you have to know how to do it, and I'm going to tell you how to do it. It's actually quite simple. What you're going to do is you're going to employ what I call kind of a verbal Aikido. Do you know what Aikido is? It's that martial arts where you use the other person's energy against them. You don't oppose the energy. You don't fight against them. You use their energy. Okay? And so when you see Steven Seagal who does that on TV, the guy with the ponytail? The Steven Seagal movie? I know you guys never watch any of those movies. Right. Where he's not upset somebody's going to come after him. He's just all relaxed. You know, it's like, don't bother me, man. Come on down. You know, and the guy comes at him and he just kind of steps aside a little bit, and as the guy flies by, he reaches in and does this really fast, and the guy hits the wall and there's broken bones and everything. He's not even broken a sweat. So that's Aikido. So we're going to do something like that. We're going to use the other person's energy against them. Instead of trying to fight them, because we don't have the ability to fight the person, we're overmatched by them, we are going to turn the tables and we are going to move. Once you realize you're overmatched, and this is not going to be a productive conversation for you to advance your own view, I want you to switch immediately from persuasion mode into fact-finding mode. You switch from persuasion mode into fact-finding mode. Okay? And here's the way it looks. You say something like this. Wow, you seem to know a whole lot more about this than I do. Okay? Because they do, apparently. You acknowledge that. You're the man. You seem to know a lot more about this than I do. I wonder if you could do me a favor. Could you just slow down a little bit? And I just want to get a paper out, or I just want to pay attention because I want to understand your view clearly here. And I want you to slow down and then explain to me clearly what your view is, what your point of view is on this, and then give me as clearly as possible the reasons that you have for it. Okay? So, by the way, did you notice the two Columbo questions there? What do you mean by that? How'd you come to that conclusion? This is all you're asking. This is the core of critical thinking skills. What the heck is that person talking about? And can they give good reasons for it? You want to do critical thinking? There it is. What's the big idea? You get clear on that so there's no ambiguities and there's no nonsense going on. Sometimes that takes a little while to get clarity. Then you want to know whether there is evidence or support for the view. What is it? So now once they give you that, you can do an assessment of it, but you can't assess until you do that. So that's all you're asking here. Slow down. Maybe I'll take some notes. You know, because I just want to get it. And then you say, then let me think about it. Then let me think about it. Now, them's the magic words. And the reason is because if you have a tough person that's very well educated who disagrees with you, and you know you cannot countermand their evidence, well, you can turn it into a learning opportunity. Instead of fighting them, you say, you want to beat me up? Okay. Come on down. Just do it slowly and thoroughly, please. That's basically what you're saying. Give me your point of view. Give me all your reasons for it. I'll take notes. Then let me think about it. Now, when you say, then let me think about it, do you have any obligation now to respond to the challenge? No. You've already said, I'm stupid, you're smart, I'm here to learn. You have no obligation anymore to respond. If they press you a little bit on it, you can just remind them, yeah, I'm going to have to think about this. You've said some very intriguing things, you've offered some challenging thoughts, I just have to think about it. All right? Now, let me ask you this question. Now, who is in control of the conversation? You or them? You are. Even though they're doing the talking, you are now in the driver's seat. You have switched that just like that in a way that that person didn't even know. They still think they're in charge because they're doing all the talking. But what are you doing? You are out from under the gun now. You don't have to answer any questions. And he's given you the chapter and verse on his view so that then when you're done, you can do what you said you were going to do. Think about it. Because now you got notes. And you can go back and at your leisure, on your own time, when the pressure is off, very important factor, then you can consider what he said. And then you can consult your resources. You can go to our website, sdr.org. You can call me on the radio during office hours on the radio and ask me questions. People do this all the time. It's not hard. It's just a phone call. Go to books that you've purchased here. You could ask friends of Kindred Spirit who's done a little study. You could Google the issue. There are all kinds of resources you can access now to help. Now that you have the point of view and the reasons for it, now you can construct a response. I'll tell you, when you do that, you write that stuff down, then you do a little homework and you construct a response. Now that issue is something you've got. You own it. It's yours. You probably aren't going to get caught up short in that again. Next time an issue comes up, a smart guy rolls over the top of you, say, okay, slow down a little bit. You know a lot more about this than I do. Can you tell me what you believe and why you believe it? And I'll listen, I'll take notes, and then let me think about it. Is that hard? Is there anybody in this room that can't say to a tough person with lots of information rolling over the top of you, that can't say to them, oh, you want to beat me up? Okay, just do it slowly and thoroughly, please. I mean, even the most timid, shy, retiring, bashful, anybody here can do that. Anybody can do it. And that's how you get an education. And that's how you deal with your fear of the other side. Because the closer you get, I learned this when I debated Michael Shermer. Michael's a tough debate opponent. He's a smart guy. He's been around the block. He's the founder of Skeptic Magazine. He's got a certain air about him that's very likable. He's a nice-looking guy. He's got a long mane of hair, and he's wears a leather jacket when he debates. Like he's he's just cool. And he's not grouchy. And so he's a tough opponent. And so as I'm preparing for my debate against him, and I'm thinking, oh man, I don't want to hear his voice. I don't want to open his books. Oh gosh, I got to do this though, because it just bothers me. Because there's this fear. What is he going to say that I'm not going to be able to deal with? That's the fear. I understand that. And then I started reading his books. And I thought, he believes that? And those are his reasons? And that's the best he can do? Oh my goodness. And what I found out, and I listened to a debate he did with oh goodness, what's his name? What's so great about Dinesh D'Souza? He did a debate with Dinesh D'Souza, and I listened to it over and over and over and over again. I wanted not to get just his ideas, but I wanted to get his rhythm, the way he thinks, and everything like that. And every time I listened to it, I got more relaxed. That is, the closer that I got to Michael Shermer, the less scary he looked. See, we look at scary people and we think, oh man, I don't know if I can deal with that. Stay away. You stay over there. You're too scary. Well, they'll stay scary if they stay over there. But if we take the courage, in a certain sense, to get closer, to listen to what they have to say, to engage the ideas, to draw them out, to ask the right questions, we start realizing that, wow, they don't have as like powerful arguments as I thought they had. And it was a great lesson for me. I wrote an article about it afterwards, about the closer you get, the better you are, not the farther away you are. And I employed that. That was one of the mentoring letters that I sent out that I promised I'll send to you if you signed up for it. So that applies in this situation. You got the tough guy, you're in the hot seat, just move towards them. Let them say their thing. Don't be afraid of it, just write it down. You don't have to answer it then. I promise you, there is not a single thing that anyone can bring up that has not been addressed by some really smart, thoughtful, careful person on our side. In fact, if you look at the history of philosophy, it's a set of books, but Copleston's History of Philosophy, like 10 volumes. From the time of Jesus up until the 19th century, just about every single person in there is a biblically committed theist. The smartest men that ever lived on the planet. Sorry, ladies, it's mostly men in that particular case. There's a lot of smart women, but for whatever reason, they're... Recently, they've made their contribution, but not then. Culture wasn't built that way at the time. The point is, the smartest people on the planet in the history of the world have included a massive amount of thoughtful, biblically literate Christians who believed the Bible was God's revelation to the world. And they were a lot better thinkers than most people nowadays. Mm-hmm. And the new atheists, these are the so-called new atheists, these guys are, that is child's play. Real philosophers who are atheists, like Michael Ruse and others, they tell the new atheists, please stop doing what you're doing. You're embarrassing us. Real atheistic philosophers. But we got the goods on these. So you don't have to be afraid of any of these challenges. The resources are out there. Okay. Now, we've talked about the first two uses of Columbo, gathering information, reversing the burden of proof. I want to move into the third use of Columbo. Now, this is a little bit more advanced, because in the first two uses of Columbo, which is the core of the game plan, if I told you no more, I would have fulfilled my promise. That have given you a game plan that will allow you to maneuver in any conversation, no matter how little you know or how much the other person knows or how aggressive or articulate they happen to be. So I've fulfilled my promise. I'm going to take you a step further here in the last 45 minutes. The third use of Columbo requires that you know something. The first two, you don't know anything. You're gathering information, in fact, using your first two questions. That's why anybody can use it. In the third use of Columbo, you have to know something. And this is where in the book, I use one characterization of the third use of Columbo. And here's what I call it. I found an easier way to put it, but I'll tell you what I say in the book, and then I'll tell you the easier way. What I say in the book is that you use your questions to lead. To lead a person to something. I suggest that you have a target in mind, and your questions are like arrows aiming at the target. Now, if you're going to use questions to lead somebody somewhere, what is it that you have to know first? Where you're going to take them. And that's going to depend entirely on the nature of the conversation. But you have to know that. And if you don't know where to go, and you get through your first two questions, the conversation's pretty much at an end. You can't go any further. And that's okay. Nothing wrong with that. But it may be that you want to you have more to say. You want to take them to a destination. And you're going to use questions to do that. I'll give you some illustrations of that in a moment. Here's the way I phrase it now. Now I just simply say, you use questions to make a point. You use questions to make a point. Now maybe the point that you're making is that you're trying to explain your own view. Sometimes people want to know your view. Well, how do you explain that view? I think the best way to explain our view is to use questions of the other person to get it done. So I wrote the book Relativism with Frank Beckwith in 1998, and soon after I had a Barnes & Noble that asked me to come and do a presentation on the book material, and this is where they come and put chairs between the aisles there, and the author pitches the book and answers questions and signs books. Two in my case, but in any event. Somebody came up and asked me a question about Christianity. Now, the book isn't about Christianity. It doesn't mention Christ anywhere in the book, the Relativism book. It does talk about God towards the end. It's a pre-evangelism kind of book, if you will. But this fellow came up to me and he said, why do I need to believe in Jesus? Why do I need to believe in your Jesus? That is, the Jesus of the New Testament. I said, he said, I'm Jewish. And I believe in God and I try to live the best life that I can live. Why do I need Jesus? Now, this is a very fair question. And it wasn't in a hostile fashion. He wanted to know. Now, there's a lot of ways to deal with this. One way is preaching at people. But I realized I needed to try to trade on things that he already believed in order to answer his question. First of all, I knew the answer to the question, why Jesus was the only way. That's real important. You got to know the answer to that question. And then I decided to get to the answer by asking questions. And indeed, I said to him, do you mind if I ask you a couple questions? He said, no, go ahead. I said, do you think that people who commit moral crimes, who do bad things, ought to be punished? He said, well, since I'm a prosecuting attorney, yeah. Now, I got lucky in the attorney thing. I didn't know that until he said it. Is that a piece of information that might be helpful to me? Bada boom. I said, good. I agree with you. We are both on the same at the same place here. We both agree that people who do bad things ought to be punished. Second question, have you ever done any bad things? That's exactly the way I put it. Have you ever done any bad things? Now, this is a personal question, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not accusing him of being a sinner. I'm asking him. What do you think he said? Yeah. He said, yeah, I guess I have. What did I say? So have I. And then I said, look where we've come in just two questions, 30 seconds. I said, we both agree that those people who do bad things ought to be punished, and we both believe that we've done those things. Do you know what I call that? He said, what? I said, bad news. Is that bad news? Yeah. Of course it's bad news. Do I need to tell this man he's a sinner?
No.
No, why not? He just told me. He knows it, and he told me. And he told me because I asked the right question. Do I need to tell this man he's under judgment? No. He just told me. Now, he wasn't thinking about either of those things when he walked into the Barnes & Noble. What did I do? I generously, genially, in a friendly fashion, just asked a couple of questions to bring these things out. Now they are out there on the table, and he put them there. Right? Now I've got something to work with. I said, I want you to think about it. It's as if God is about to lower the gavel on you and I, and we're both in the docket. And we know we're guilty and we deserve what we're going to get. And God pauses and says, are either of you guys interested in a pardon? Does clemency sound good right about now? Does it? When you're in the docket, for goodness sake, yes. By the way, that is the importance of coming with the bad news first. Then the good news. Bad news first. Than the good news, because the good news is not good news without the bad news. I'm going to tell you something that's going to shock you, but you can look it up for yourself. There are 13 times the gospel is preached in the book of Acts. That is, these are the people who Jesus personally trained to take his message after him. And not a single time is the love of God mentioned. In fact, the love of God is not, the word love doesn't even appear in the book of Acts. Now, is the love of God manifest there? Yes, it's manifest in the message, but that isn't what they communicated. They communicated the bad news first, and then the good news is good news. Escape what you have coming to you. I don't know how many people care about insulin in here, but all of you would care about it right quick if you found out you had diabetes.
That's right.
Because you don't care about the solution unless you know what the problem is. That's why it's so important for us to be very straightforward to people with the problem. The problem is sin. The problem is rebellion. And deep in our heart, we actually know this. And Jesus came to solve a problem. And so I explained this to him, and I didn't get into a lot of detail. I said, yeah, I'm interested in a pardon. And what the Father says, who is the judge, is he said, I've made provision for your crime by taking the punishment on myself when I became a man in the person of Jesus. Jesus paid the rap for our crimes. So I'm speaking his language, right, as an attorney.
Yep.
But I'm also speaking the language of the New Testament. He bore our sins. For him who does not work, let's see how Paul puts it this way. For anybody who works for salvation, what they get is what God owes them. If you think you work for your salvation, well then, by golly, God's got to give it to you because he owes it to you. You earned it. But Paul says, by contrast, but for him who does not work, this is Romans 4, look it up. And it's not an isolated verse, it's part of a whole argument that starts in chapter 1 and goes to chapter 8. But for him who does not work, but believes in a God who justifies the ungodly, to him it is reckoned as righteous. Jesus took our crimes upon himself so that we can get his righteousness. 2 Corinthians 5:21. He made him who knew no sin to be sin in our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. We get his goodness, he gets our sin. That's what the Reformers called the Great Exchange. And that's called substitutionary atonement. It's called justification. Different theological words. I didn't use any of those with the attorney. I just explained it to him. Jesus is the only way because he's the only one who paid. Now, if you don't take Jesus' payment, I told the attorney, then you pay. That's it. You pay or he pays. What do you want? Because you know that you deserve what you're going to get. That's not going to be a pretty picture. So what's it going to be? You're going to do it on your own? You're going to earn your way to heaven? The prophet says, Isaiah 64, all our righteous deeds are like filthy rags, and just to be, we're dealing with adults here, that's a sanitized translation. Bloody, stinking, menstrual cloths is what the word in the Hebrew means. That's what our good deeds look like to a holy God. And our iniquities, like the wind, carry us away. Goodness isn't the problem. It's badness that's the problem. And Jesus saves us from badness. Sure. And when he saves us completely. So what did I do? I explained the work of the cross and answered a challenging question with this attorney by leading with questions that of him that allowed me to get some information onto the table. Okay? I already talked about the passive aggressive tolerance trick. I was actually just thinking of one other illustration that I used with a Muslim woman on an airplane. She was sitting next to me on the right. She'd actually switched seats with someone else spouses who were split up and they wanted to sit together, so she switched and she ended up next to me. And in the process of our conversation, drawing out with questions, she's a Muslim from Iran, lives in the States, pretty westernized, but is having doubts about Islam. And so I told her, there's two things that I want you to know, that to think about, because she was asking me about it, that are differences between Christianity and Islam. So I'm just going to give you two things to chew on. I'm not giving her a whole bunch. This is another important thing. I've just given her two things. I said, first, In Islam and in Christianity, they're not the same gods, by the way. They're very different.
Absolutely.
All right? Just so you're not confused about this. A lot of Christians are confused about this. In the God of Muhammad is a God who cares about justice, just as the God in holiness, just as the God of Abraham, but they claim the same. Let's say just the God of Christianity. Let's just put it that way. That's the way I put it to her. But the God of Christianity became a man in order to pay for our crimes. The God of Islam is out there. The God of Christianity came right down here, humbled himself, took on the form of a human being, and not just a human being, but humbled himself as a servant. And this is in Philippians chapter 2, is a long explanation of that. Have this mind also in yourself, which is in Christ Jesus, that even though he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God's thing to be held onto, but he humbled himself and he emptied himself and he took on the form of a bondservant. He became a man and he died the death of a common criminal. I mean, it's a powerful passage of who Jesus is. It's a Christological passage of the incarnation. I didn't get into all that. I just said the God of Christianity came down to us. He's not way out there. He came down to us to rescue us. And here's what he did to rescue us. And this is the second thing. And then I said, Ati, it's as if, just think if we were captured by terrorists and the terrorists came down the aisle and they were picking out people to slit their throats and throw them on the tarmac for CNN. And they came on to grab you. And when they came to grab you, I put my arms in front of you and I said, don't take Ati. Take me instead. And they took me and slit my throat and threw me out in the tarmac. What would you think? And she said, I could not imagine anybody doing anything like that for me. She was stunned just by the mere illustration. Notice I'm asking questions here. And then I said, that is what Jesus did. God as a man in Jesus who said, Father, don't take her, take me instead. That's the substitutionary atonement.
Amen.
Now, sometimes you'll have, let me go back to the professor example. Sometimes you want to use a question to show a weakness or a flaw. Okay? One professor said to a student that came to me afterwards, that she was an anthropology professor and the student studying anthropology so she could be a missionary. The professor was generally in favor of that student's own Christianity. Of course, you can have your own religion. We encourage people to believe what they want to believe. But then when the student told the professor she was planning to be a missionary, the professor stepped in and said, no, you shouldn't do that because it's wrong to try to change other people's religious beliefs. So now she's imposing this kind of pluralistic mentality on the Christian student. Now the Christian student's flummoxed because she's thinking, well, I am imposing my religious beliefs, but how do I answer my professor in a way that would be appealing or compelling to the professor? So you see the difficulty here. What she doesn't see was the problem in the professor's response. I saw the problem, and so I suggested that she go back to her professor with a question. And this is a question with Columbo number 3 that is meant to exploit a weakness or a flaw in somebody else's point of view. I said, you go back to the professor who said that it's wrong to be a missionary in other cultures because it's wrong to try to change other people's religious point of view. You ask your professor if she is at that moment attempting to change your own religious view. Because Christianity is a missionary religion. Mm-hmm. It's the command given to the church by Jesus just before he ascended into heaven, go and make disciples. That's part of our theology. Whether it's wrong or it's right is not the issue. It's part of our theology. And here's a professor saying it's wrong to change other people's theological perspective. But she's telling that to a Christian who is trying to fulfill the Great Commission. So is that professor trying to change the Christian's theological perspective? Persuasion. Absolutely. But she doesn't realize it. Her point of view is committing suicide. It's a suicide tactic, but we're using a Columbo tactic along with it. Now, you could say, well, professor, you're trying to change my point of view. You're doing the very thing that you're telling me not to do. That would be an appropriate response, but you'd lose a tactical advantage. Why not make the same point with a question? Ask the question, well, Professor, are you trying to change my theological view right now? No. You know Christianity is a missionary religion, right? And we are obliged to tell other people and try to persuade them, right? Aren't you telling me I shouldn't be doing that? Well, yes, I am. So then you're trying to change my own theological view. But I thought you thought that was wrong. Help me out here. Is that over with? That's over with. But you used the questions. You saw the problem. You got to see the problem. Once you see the problem, then you use the question. Now, the rest of the tactics book, and the suicide tactic, taking the roof off, just the facts, man, Rhodes Scholar, these are all maneuvers to help you see the problem. But usually you're going to use the Columbo tactic to exploit the problem. So the professor says the Bible's a bunch of fables. You ask, how'd you come to that conclusion? Professor says, well, the Bible's got a lot of miracles in it. When you say, yes, well, the professor says, well, miracles don't happen. Mm-hmm. Well, now the professor's just done what? Mm-hmm. He's made a what?
Claim.
A claim. And what's the rule of the burden of proof? The person who makes the claim bears the burden. So whose job is it now to defend the claim that miracles don't happen? It's not your job to prove they do. It's his job to defend that they don't. So now you have a question. And what's your question of the professor when he says that that miracles don't happen? How'd you come to that conclusion? What are your reasons for that? Well, the professor says, science has proven that miracles don't happen. Well, now when the professor says that, I know I got him. Because science has proven nothing of the sort. In fact, science is not capable of proving that miracles don't happen.
That's right.
Can you weigh a chicken with a yardstick?
Nope.
Now, in Southern California, they have engineers. And when I ask that question, I can see their mind. They're going, oh, I can make a balancing beam out of this, and I'll make it happen, you know? So, no, you don't weigh a chicken with a yardstick. Yardsticks are meant to measure things. They're not meant to weigh things. Okay? If you want to weigh things, you need a scale. What is science meant to measure? What is the purpose? What is the scientific methodologies? What do they measure? They measure things in the physical world. Do they measure things in the non-physical world? No. Well, we have to have scientific proof for that miracle. There's no such thing as scientific proof. There may be evidence from testimony that gives you reason to believe it actually took place, but there can't be scientific proof for it. In the sense that people normally use the word scientific. Because the nature of a miracle just is that it seems to be a variation or violation, if you will, of natural law. It breaks the mold. So science is not capable of inveighing against the supernatural, even in principle. It's like trying to weigh a chicken with a yardstick. It doesn't even address that. It's a different way of knowing, and it's a fine way of knowing. But you can't disqualify something that science can't directly speak to. You can't disqualify it with science. Do you see the problem there? So, now I know this. And if you didn't follow that, that was a little quick. I actually have written a piece. It's on our website at str.org called Weighing a Chicken with a Yardstick, all right? And I work out the rationale there, but it's really simple. Science does one thing, it doesn't do another. When people say science has proven miracles can't happen, they're using science in a way that it can't be used for. Okay, so when the professor says science has proved that miracles don't happen, I know that's false. Now, I could say to the professor, false. Can you weigh a chicken with a yardstick? I could go all through that explanation, but that would be tedious, and everybody'd have to listen, and a lot of people wouldn't understand, just like you guys didn't know it, right? You know. So, in the case of the professor, I'm just going to say, professor says that science has proved there are no miracles, and I say, okay, professor, please describe for us exactly how science has proven that miracles are not possible. Give you the floor, sir. Sounds of silence. Because science hasn't done that. He has nothing to say. Science hasn't proven it. Science has assumed it. Because they have a metaphysical view of the reality that says only physical things exist. And there can't be miracles because there are no gods to drive miracles. We just don't allow that. Okay? It's like an article I saw in Time magazine once. The whole issue is on consciousness. Now, consciousness, that is awareness. One's awareness of one's self. Consciousness, this is a real hard thing for materialists, scientists, because consciousness is not physical. It's clearly not physical. Now, for about 80 years, they've been trying to reduce it to something physical, and they can't do it. And in this article on consciousness in Time magazine, this is 1995 in July, they actually explored this notion. At the end of the article, they came to the conclusion that we don't know what consciousness is. But one thing we know, that it is not. Consciousness is not some kernel of self inside your body that runs the show. So what are they saying? They're saying there's no soul. Now, this is the received conclusion of the scientific community right now in the neuropsychology and all of that. Everything's got to be reduced to meet all the way down to these people. There's no soul. They cannot admit that there's any soul because a soul is immaterial by definition, and they can't admit to the existence of immaterial things. They're materialists, for goodness sake. There's no room in their worldview for this. So Time magazine and its scientists have got to say there is no soul. Their whole worldview depends on it. Now, you'd think they're scientists, they'd have good reasons for saying this. So how did you come to that conclusion? Well, they tell you right there, and here are the reasons. They give two. Fasten your seatbelt. Time magazine. Scientists have been looking for the soul for 100 years and haven't been able to find it. That's the first reason. Second reason, I'm quoting. There is no conceivable space in the brain for the soul to fit. Now, many of you see the blunder already. And they could be right that there is no soul, and I could be dead wrong, but they aren't right for those reasons. Because that's like saying, you know, you told me there was an invisible man in your house. Well, I went in there and I didn't see him anywhere. I look under the bed and in the closet and back in the shed. I didn't see anybody. Well, of course you're not going to see him if he's invisible, for goodness sake. Now, that doesn't prove he exists. It just shows that that's not the right way to dismiss his existence. And by the same token, if there is a soul, you're not going to find it with your Geiger counters. Or any kind of scientific investigation. It's a philosophic reflection that allows you to discover the existence of the soul. And by the way, for some of you, I know I'm a little tight on time here, but for some of you who are maybe skeptical, well, I know a science can give me like really solid stuff, but when it comes to philosophy and religion, well, that's just way out there, and that's just belief stuff, you know, and who knows about that? Well, I'm going to do a little exercise with you to show how powerful this can be, and in this exercise, I am going to prove to you the existence of the soul. I want you to close your eyes. I want you to imagine your mother washing dishes. Picture your mother washing dishes. She's at the sink, you're behind her. You're looking at her now. What color is the blouse she's wearing? Look at the color of the blouse. Okay, open your eyes. Okay? What color of blouse was she wearing?
Blue.
Blue? Green?
White.
Did you see that? Did you see that? Did you see blue? Did you see white? Who said that? Did you see green? Did you see that? Your eyes are closed. Where was your mother? Where was she? She wasn't in your brain. You saw her. You saw your mother so well you could tell me the color of blouse she was wearing. That's real. But it isn't in your brain. You saw her with the eyes of your soul, your immaterial self. Somebody would have cracked your head open while you were having that reflection, provided you could still live. They aren't going to see your mother at the sink with a green blouse on,
right,
washing the dishes, because she wasn't in your brain. Every single year, one of your five senses you can replicate in your mind, which is the same thing as the soul. The mind is a faculty of the soul. Sight, sound, Beethoven's Fifth. How many heard it just then? Mm-hmm. Dun, 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 dun. Did you hear it? You can taste the strawberry. Mm-hmm. You can do it right now. It's not going to be as vivid as the strawberry I had in Topanga Canyon 3 days ago when the vendors there were, because I live in strawberry country. But you can taste it. You can feel fur. You can smell a rose. Mm-hmm. And nothing is happening physically. I know some people say, oh yeah, well, you know, your synapses are firing and your brain chemistry is like, well, that may be happening, but that isn't what I saw. I saw my mom with a yellow blouse washing dishes. I didn't see neurons firing. They may have been involved in the process of that happening between my body and the soul, but that isn't what any of you saw. So there's just one little exercise that we did in 5 minutes. It didn't even take that long. That is meant to break you free from this notion that science is the only thing that can tell you truth about the world. For goodness sake, a whole bunch of things have got to be true even before science can begin working. It's only one way of knowing. Notice how I worked through that professor thing, how I have the information, I knew some things, now I'm using questions. I had a guy once, and I'll use this as my last illustration here. In a Q&A session after an event kind of like this, challenge came from somebody in the audience. Prove to me that God exists. Prove to me that God exists. Okay, so I'm the professional. I got my name on the brochure, my picture's there, we've got a website, I debated Deepak Chopra, Michael Shermer. That's like telling, you know, so I'm the guy, it's like a comedian. You know, oh, you're a comedian? Be funny! Be funny. I'm on the spot, right? Oh, golly. Now what? Well, what I said is, I cannot accept your challenge the way it's offered because it's the way you put it has insurmountable barriers for me. Now, let me ask you a question. I just want you to think about this. Okay? He said, prove to me God exists. I'm not going to take the challenge offered in that way. Why not? Think about the challenge and somebody tell me what, raise your hand and I'll call on you, tell me what you think might be a liability of the challenge offered that way. Yes, sir?
You don't know what proof he requires.
Excellent. I don't know what he means by proof. Mm-hmm. By the way, what question might be a good question to ask at this point?
What do you mean by
proof?
What do you mean by God?
What do you mean by God? Okay. In this case, he probably means the God that I'm advancing. So, what do you mean by proof? You never take a challenge to prove something unless you know what kind of proof would be satisfying to that person. Now, some atheists don't want to say, well, proof, God's going to have to show up right in front of me. That would be the kind of proof. Then I go to God. And one wag said, now, if God showed up in front of you right now, you wouldn't go to God, you'd go to a psychiatrist. So that needs to be clarified, and I pointed that out to him. Secondly, you said, what's the second part that might be problematic? Anyone else? How about the phrase, to me?
Mm-hmm.
Prove to me. So now I got to give proof, whatever that is adequate to overcome any skepticism he can conjure up. Do I want to take that on? Absolutely not. I said, I don't know what's going to be compelling to you. So can you reword your question to give me something more reasonable to work with? And he said, all right. Because that's a fair complaint that I offered, right? So I'm just bargaining with him a little bit. Let's work on this. I'm not afraid of the challenge. I just want to make sure that it's a fair one. Okay? He said, all right, can you give me any legitimate reasons why there might be a God, the kind of God that you have in mind? So, all right, well, good. I can deal with that. I mean, to me, the idea of legitimate reason is probably broad enough. Okay, there's nothing, no tricks in there. All right, fine. Do you mind if I ask you a few questions? He says, no, go ahead. Some of them seem kind of simple, but just kind of go along with me, or maybe obvious. Do you believe that things exist? Yes, he said. Good. So do I. All right, good. Maybe they don't exist exactly the way we receive them, but something's there. If there's nothing else there but me, at least I'm here, right? Cogito ergo sum. Descartes' famous, I think, therefore I am. You know, I have a fishing cap that said, I fish, therefore I am. You know, so, you know, variations on the theme here. But in any event, I said, okay, good. You believe things exist. Second question, did the things that exist always exist? Well, no. In other words, the universe is not eternal. Well, virtually nobody believes that anymore. And the evidence is completely against it. That's why, scientific evidence. So he was right in line with that. He said, no, they haven't always existed. So Big Bang stuff or something like that is where he's coming from. Fine, okay, good. Third question, where did everything come from? Now, this is where you might get a little pushback. By the way, those questions fairly simple, very straightforward. Now, this is where you get a little pushback. Like I'm not a physicist. I don't know. How can I answer that question? I said, well, it's very simple. There are only two options. Everything came from something or not. Everything came from something or everything came from nothing. Those are the only two options. So what think you? Now, do you see where the bind that he's in at this particular point? What is the most obvious answer to the question I asked him? Did everything come from something or nothing?
Something.
It came from something. You know why? Because our universal experience is that things come from other things. Mm-hmm. That is, finite things have finite causes. And I should say, effects have causes that best explain them. And so the universe coming into being requires a cause adequate to the effect. This is very simple, straightforward cause and effect thinking. We do this all the time. Your wife comes home, she looks in the garage, there's a red Corvette. She said, honey, where'd the Corvette come from? He says, mine. Where'd you get it? It just appeared there. Nobody's going to believe that. Right? I was at dinner once with I can't say who it was, but it was a notable religious figure whose name is well known around the country. And at the dinner, a young man announced that he was he no longer believed in God, family member, and with some belligerence. And this surprised everybody. It was kind of an embarrassing moment, and I began to talk to him a little bit about these things, and Big Bang needs a big banger and that kind of stuff, but he was not interested in any conversation. He just kept saying, it's irrational to believe in God. What is precisely irrational about it? That's another question. What do you mean by that question? In what way, what do you mean by irrational? Spell it out for me. In any event, he wasn't going there. And I said, look, if somebody knocked on the door, what would you do? Would you think that the knock knocked itself? Or would you think that someone knocked, especially if it was a... You know, now that's design also. It's not just the noise. It's, you know, so... No, you'd answer the door. But, you know, and of course, is that the common sense response? You hear the knock, you don't think the knock knocked itself. Well, he wasn't having any of it. He wasn't listening or anything. But that's a fair point. But I'll tell you the postscript. As we had just finished dinner, dessert was on the table, and as God is my witness, from the other side of the room, the front door, I mean, I could not have planned this. Who knocks on doors anymore? They got doorbells. You guys have doorbells in Montana, right? You kind of up with that, right? So, you know, you ring the doorbell. Somebody's knocking on the door. Who does that? He looks up from his dessert. And he is startled. And he said, who's there? And I said, no one. And what did he do? And this is the clincher. He got up and he answered the door because it was not reasonable for him to think that the knock knocked itself. And the same thing is true when you ask the question, where did it all come from? It came from something or it came from nothing. If you say it came from nothing, you are offering something completely irrational and absurd. But if you say it came from something, the something has to be adequate to the effect. If the universe is the effect, the material world is the effect, the temporal world is the effect, then something that is outside of time, or at least outside of history, outside of the material realm, that is immaterial, that is powerful and probably pretty smart, is responsible for the universe as we experience it. Now, I don't know about you, but that's getting pretty close to God. We haven't really done that much work, have we? We just asked a few questions. So here is an example of taking a very simple argument. This is a version of the cosmological argument for God's existence, showing that the best explanation for the existence of the cosmos, the stuff, is that God is the one responsible. That the cosmos is organized a certain way, that's a different kind of argument. That's the design argument. That's different. I'm just talking about why it's here. But I'm using questions at each step of the way, so when I get to the question of, okay, is it something or nothing, what say you? Now he's got to commit himself one way or another. If he says something, then he's in my camp. I've just given him, now he has given me a good reason to believe in God. And if he says nothing, he's got to side with the knock-knocking itself. And if he does that, I'm saying, well, you got more faith than I do. Faith of a leap of faith kind. And I can't go that direction. Don't call yourself rational at this point. Please just be intellectually honest in saying you're opting for whatever reason for the most absurd option. So there's another way how these questions can be in play. In the book, I have lots more illustrations, and sometimes even in talks, I give too much illustrations because it's one after another, and I have sometimes my host says just give one or two and don't confuse us with all the details. So I've given you a few to kind of give you a taste for how this works, and I've kind of sketched out this game plan for you. I've encouraged you not to swing for the fences. I encourage you not to get out of play because you think you have to hit homers. You don't have to go for the close. It's not what we're after here. We need a lot of gardeners in play. Okay? Now, therefore I'm saying, be a gardener, shoot there, get to the gospel if you're able to. If you don't get there, that's all right too. Do the good that you can with the opportunity that God has given you, and then put your trust in God to take it from there. Just put a stone in their shoe. That's the goal. Okay, that's what we're shooting for. How do we get there? We got a game plan now. We got a game plan called the Columbo tactic, in which we use questions in a very deliberate way to maneuver through conversations. The first two questions, we don't need to know anything to ask those questions. In fact, we ask them because we're ignorant. We are engaged with somebody else. We're drawing them out. Maybe we haven't gotten to spiritual things yet, but we're going to take the opportunity to be friendly, draw them out, and then listen. We're listening for an opening or an opportunity if the Lord gives us a foothold, so to speak, in a conversation, then to go further. We're asking questions to get information, and we're using some version of the question, what do you mean by that? And we're alert to the fact that some people don't know what they mean by that, and if they give us a silence, then we're going to draw them out, probe with them, let them do most of the talking. There's no pressure on us. We want to understand. But we're listening, because when we're listening, we're going to be getting things from the other person that we can then make use of in a good way to further the conversation. If it turns out that the occasion presents itself, we would also reverse the burden of proof. We are not going to let the other person just say their point of view and presume that they're right because they get to say it. We're not going to let them off that easy. We're going to ask them to do a little bit of work. If they're going to an advance of view, we're going to ask them, what are the reasons for that view? And this is reversing the burden of proof. That is, we're putting the burden of proof on the person who's making the claim. If we are not making the claim, we don't have any responsibility, and we are going to be alert to attempts by the other person to push the responsibility on us. We're going to resist that. If we're not making claims, we have nothing to prove. All right? And so if we are in this question-asking mode using the first two types of Columbo, then we are in question, in just gathering information. We're not trying to prove anything. Now, as time goes on, and I encourage you in the next couple weeks, just practice those two questions and be a learner. Don't put yourself under any more pressure than that. I think you will find in just doing that that it gets very easy after time. And I know that there's some people here who have taken the tactics material, read the book, and have been putting this into play because I've talked to them. And they can tell you, man, what a difference this makes. And when you get comfortable with that, then you may want to be thinking about advancing a particular point that you have, either explaining your own view or maybe exploiting a weakness or a flaw in the other person's view, but you use your questions to do that. Think of ways that you might ask questions to do that. Now, how do you think of those? Well, the best time to think of clever things to say in a tough situation is when you're not under pressure. And the two times you're not under pressure is before you have the encounter or after you have the encounter. And sometimes the more productive time is afterwards because you've had it and you realize what a fool you made out of yourself. And you're thinking, well, how could I have done better? Right? I almost remember that actor's name. Needham, Notham. So you can think of before, gee, I've been in the circumstances like this. I don't know how I'd respond. Maybe I better think of questions beforehand. Then I'm ready. Or after your encounter, gee, what should I have said? Then review it, role play it, get it in your mind. Then you'll have it for next time around. Write it down if you have to. I do this all the time. All the time. And this is why it seems like I'm faster on my feet than some of you, only because I've practiced beforehand. Okay? Our goal is not to lose our cool. We want to be good ambassadors. We don't want to get into a fight. If we get mad, we lose. If they get mad, we lose. So we're trying to have the most genial interaction we possibly can have. And we're going to use a game plan to accomplish that, that gives us a lot of margin for error, doesn't put a lot of pressure on us, but fulfills Paul's exhortation to conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity, seasoning your words with salt so that you know how to respond to each person. Last word. The last chapter of the book is titled More Sweat, Less Blood. And I've adapted it from a Marine training slogan, which says, the more that you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. The more that you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. That applies to us here in these things. There's a battle out there. It is a serious battle. A war is raging. It's a spiritual battle more than anything else. But the stakes are very, very high. Every one of you who is a follower of Christ is a player in that game. You are an ambassador for Christ. And the more you take that seriously and you sweat in training, the less blood you will let when you get in battle, and blood does flow. Yeah. I mentioned yesterday, read Matthew 10. I hope you read it tonight if you didn't read it last night. And if you did read it last night, I hope you read it again tonight. Behold, I have told you in advance. I have warned you in advance. Do not fear them. Do not fear them. Did you find that in there? There it was. And with that, I commend you to the Lord Jesus Christ and the power of His grace to fulfill the commission that He's entrusted to you and I for His glory. Thank you.